The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. We've had guests in the past, Dave, that have brought out the dangers of corporate profits if they come by the wrong purposes. And what I'm thinking about is if they take corporate money and turn around and buy their own shares back, one, they reduce the amount of shares that are outstanding, and two, they boost the profitability per share. But they're not really adding anything to the company, are they?
No, that really is accounting gimmickry. Financial Times last week noted that bankers are growing more and more concerned that there are lots of loans that the banking community is making to U.S. businesses, and the proceeds from those loans are going to special dividends, they're going to share buybacks, they're going to acquisitions, but disturbing to them, being in the creditor position, is that they're not supporting organic growth. They're not going towards growing their businesses via research and development, via CapEx spending, via the things that you would need to do to take a company from here to there just on a natural course.
In a way, it's like a false high. I mean, it's like taking a caffeine jolt and thinking that you've got more energy and that it's lasting and sustainable, isn't it?
Well, it's exactly what you get when you start connecting the dots between the kind of unhealthy, incentivized behavior that corporate executives have with Janet Yellen and the Fed. It's unhealthy consequences, and this is what abounds in a low interest rate environment.
Right. Yeah, artificially low interest rates. I mean, let's face it, cheap money right now is flowing into these companies, but the problem is it's not creating any real growth.
No, this is what we would call capital misallocation. Yeah, so this is what happens when central banks get involved in determining the course and flow of funds rather than markets determining the flow of funds. You end up with a misallocation of capital. And I'll tell you this, misallocation is always what comes before capital destruction. So capital misallocation precedes capital destruction.
You know, Yellen's on TV right now. It's the Humphrey Hawkins testimony, and so she's being interviewed. And it's interesting to listen to what these people say versus what they do, because she's actually acknowledging the very problem we're pointing out, yet she's not changing anything.
No, and there is an awareness of what interest rates do. I mean, these are very bright people. It's not that they're missing the implications or the consequences of the actions that they're taking. She said last week, I am mindful of the potential for low interest rates to heighten the incentives of financial participants to reach for yield and take on risk. She said a lot of other things in that presentation, but it's curious that when markets begin to implode, the same Fed officials who sort of created bubble dynamics distance themselves from the cause and effect relationship. Again, between the policies that they put in motion and the bubbles that are conceived by them, they love to sidestep that in the moment of pressure. Right now, they can say, oh, sure, we see that this is a problem, but you know, frankly, it's a problem that they created. It's a problem they're not going to do anything about until it's too late.
Well, and you know, Dave, we've talked about noise canceling out actual true information. And it's not just happening here. I mean, look at overseas right now. You've got foreign debt. You were talking about Spanish debt, actually, from an interest rate perspective, looking safer than U.S. debt. I mean, when is that going to be addressed?
Yeah, the sort of the late 2013 to mid-year 2014 trend in the world of fixed income or government treasuries around the world has been that not only have rates come down, but the difference between European debt and U.S. treasuries has also contracted. The spread has narrowed, so to say. Spanish government debt, is it really safer than U.S. government debt?
I mean, you've got more than 50% unemployment. Anyone who's below the age of 30 has a 1 in 2 chance of being out of work.
Now, we're not saying that it is safer, but certainly you have distorted rates, and those distorted rates are sending a very confused message.
Well, isn't part of the problem, though, Dave, just the way they label things? Because there are regulations in these banks, and some of this debt has been labeled risk-free debt, which means there's certain regulations that allow them to take more on.
This is confusing to me, quite frankly, Kevin, because on the one hand, you've got the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, which now says they see problems with the current practice, which in fact was encouraged by the Basel III agreement of including government bonds in the category of risk-free assets. So the Committee on Banking Supervision says, we think there's a problem here, and yet it's the Bank of International Settlements, a part of the Basel Committee. The Basel Committee on Banking Supervision is a subdivision, if you will, of the BIS. And so I don't think they're either not talking or they go ahead and set a policy in motion, and then only after the fact see that there's a negative consequence from it. But again, they're now saying, yes, this is a bad idea to have all government bonds treated as a risk-free asset, because what they've seen, what they've witnessed, is a flood of bank assets go into government paper. And I think everyone knows, including the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, they know how destabilizing it can be when you have either a re-emergent credit crisis in Europe, which is still on the table, or let's say on a broader scale, you have a rise in interest rates on a global basis. That's going to impact the assets on those bank balance sheets. And again, you can treat them as risk-free, but when interest rates start to rise, they're anything but risk-free in terms of what happens to the mark-to-market value of those assets.
Well, and I think that's the thing that's bothering me so much right now, Dave. All the markets, I mean, not just the interest rate markets, but the stock market, we can talk about that in a little while. And the volatility in these markets is actually spelling out the word certainty. Certainty that interest rates are going to stay low, certainty that the stock market's going to continue to rise, certainty that any kind of European debt crisis like we've had before is behind us. But certainty turns into panic when people find out that they're wrong.
Well, in our conversations, we've always talked about low volatility being an indication of a certain future outcome. And that's what we have today, a low volatility environment. Whether you're looking at the volatility index or any measure of volatility, it's incredibly low. And it does imply that there is certainty about an outcome.
Sort of a perceived stability.
And that's exactly what it is. It's a perceived stability in the Eurozone, and it's just that. It is a perception. Not that it's any different in the U.S. We have a perceived reality. You know, listen, what is $50 to $100 billion a month in money printing and monetization of assets get you here in the United States? It gets you perceived stability,
yeah,
which is apparently good enough for most of today's market practitioners. Again, what you see, though, is not necessarily what you get. In recent days, I think we have seen a more rational judgment in Europe. All of a sudden, interest rates are rising. Why? Well, banks have suffered another round of pressure, particularly in Portugal. Even though European banks have been recapitalized, it's becoming obvious that, listen, they still have high leverage, they still have derivative exposure, they still have off-balance sheet exposure, which was just sort of wiped under the carpet, swept under the carpet. There's things that, again, just because they have access to a little bit more capital doesn't mean that they've fixed the problems that led them into crisis, peak of which was 2011, and we're beginning to see, again, cracks within the European banking system. This notion of perceived stability, you know how quickly it can come undone.
You know, Dave, I think about measuring things. You know, if I had a yardstick and somebody said, how many yards is a football field, or how many yards is this tennis court, or the office? If I had a yardstick that was accurate in size, I could give you an accurate measurement. But you know, you look at the variability of Federal Reserve decision making or central banks in general, and there's really very few rules or transparency that is there to where we can actually measure how well they're doing. They say, yeah, we're going to taper, or we're thinking possibly of raising interest rates next year or the year after that, or we're going to continue to do this or that. Where are the rules, Dave, for the Federal Reserve?
Well, I mean, speaking of rules that are pending, we've got the Federal Reserve Accountability and Transparency Act of 2014. Now, just think about that. Can you imagine a world in which we had the Federal Reserve and there was accountability? Can you imagine a world in which there was the Federal Reserve and transparency, and all of this could be delivered to you in 2014? Now, granted, that's just the title of the legislation, but there are some interesting details in the legislation. Our guest, John Taylor from Stanford, he is with the proposal of this legislation. He's ecstatic because it's the first measure of accountability given to the Fed, or proposed anyways, in decades. And if you recall our discussion with him probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, what we discussed with John was the need for rules-based policy measures instead of the current discretionary orientation. And what we mean by discretionary is make it up as you go along, learn as you go, the kinds of things that we've heard from Greenspan and Bernanke as literally being an unscripted play-by-play, it's going to come, not quite like jazz, where there is some sort of organizing principle. There's no organizing principle when it comes to Fed policy. It literally is fly by the seat of your pants.
It's a little bit like chaos. Well, you know, when we talk about transparency, now what I'm hoping for is transparency in what their plan is and what rules they're following, not necessarily the transparent goal that we think maybe Germany is starting to wonder, is it truly transparent?
Well, right. It's just the issue of we'll do whatever it takes. I mean, and that's a blanket that includes everything under the universe, includes things that may be morally reprehensible. Not that it would include them, but it doesn't exclude them. When you open up discretionary monetary policy, it literally is you can do anything any way you can, preferably not breaking the law. But, you know, what you have with a rules orientation is some level of accountability. And here's how you can expect us to operate. Now you can judge us by our own yardstick. We told you we were going to do A, B, and C. How did we do? Did we measure up to A, B, C? How did we measure up against our own standard? That's really what's proposed in the Federal Reserve Accountability and Transparency Act of 2014. Now, you're going to hear a lot of talk, I think, about how terrible that is, because look how, you know, hogtied our officials would have been in the context of dealing with the 2008-2009 crisis. And yet you talk to central bankers with more historical reference, and you know what they'll tell you is actually the market does very well if they understand what rules we're playing by. If the game is established and we know the rules, it's a lot easier than the kind of environment we're in now, where literally everything changes with one utterance from the Fed, because the whole game can change. The rules can be different tomorrow than from today. And so you've got an entire market, both fixed income, bond investors, equity investors, that is stock market investors, who are fixated on Fed language and what is the next utterance, because from their mouths to God's ear, that is exactly what is going to create reality. Instead of stepping back and saying, we understand what they're going to do, we understand how they're going to do it, and there's no way to game them or to somehow take advantage of others in the marketplace by being 2 seconds early and not 1 second late in the race to, you know, take advantage of the newest utterance from the Fed. It just means that the investment markets in a discretionary environment have become nothing but a casino.
Well, and the disconnect is amazing to me because, you know, June's retail sales figures seem like they were gaining. But, you know, you talk to the guys at Walmart, you talk to the guys at the Family Dollar stores, container stores, what have you. They were saying, uh-oh, it was not a strong seasonal winter that caused the contraction. We have a major contraction that's going back. I mean, it looks like retail sales have fallen back to 2008 levels.
Well, you know, June retail numbers, they bumped in part because of food inflation. So that's, I mean, something relevant to keep your mind on. Just let that sit in the back of your mind. In future months, when we look at retail sales figures, one of the things, one of the inputs that you have to factor in or factor out as inflation increases, what is an increase in consumer spending and what is just a reflection of the higher costs of goods and services, where people aren't necessarily increasing their spending per se, but they are increasing what it takes to buy the old goods and services. So we did have a little bit of that in June. But you're right, we have the folks that run the Family Dollar store basically say, listen, we're in a retail funk. I mean, when you have an earnings call and you basically say, yeah, this last quarter, there's a real retail funk. The problem was we didn't have enough bodies coming through the door. And then you look at Walmart. Listen, we've had five quarters of declining sales. And again, Walmart to me is something of a bellwether. You can look at other retailers like Amazon and look at their stock share performance of the last several months, and you've got a similar story. But far more compelling to me is Walmart. I mean, folks, if we have a recovery in the economy, the middle class should be throwing off their fears. They should be getting out there for a little retail therapy. They should be in Walmart buying like there's no tomorrow. And in fact, five quarters of declining sales, that's very significant to me.
Well, you know, all of this is well and good. I mean, you can keep interest rates low. You can actually even endure slowdowns in retail sales as long as the dollar stays the reserve currency of the world. But, you know, look, we're looking at China right now, Dave. It's just about to surpass $4 trillion in their own reserves, and they're looking to other countries. They're saying, you know, the dollar probably is not going to be where we're going to be in the long run. That's $4 trillion or more. I mean, it may be more.
Let me just suggest something to you, because, you know, we just mentioned Walmart. It's not that Walmart captures all of the imports in the United States, but it is a decent litmus for our trade with China, because frankly, 98% of the products in Walmart come from China. So how is it that we've got declining sales in Walmart, and yet we continue to see Chinese foreign currency exchange reserves go through the roof? $3.99 trillion. My guess is that we finish above $4.25 trillion by the end of the year. One of the things that this suggests to me is they continue to increase their foreign exchange reserves. But there is a reorientation. The irony here is that there is a reorientation away from U.S. dollar trade, import-exports with the United States, and a much broader audience the world over who's interested in buying Chinese
goods. So they've got more reserve money, but it's not necessarily ours. It's not necessarily the dollar.
Well, they may continue to buy treasuries. They may not continue to buy treasuries, but the source of the funds and the problem in terms of the import and export imbalance, what I'm suggesting to you is this is not being exclusively driven by the U.S. dollar. They're trading a lot regionally and with other trade partners around the world. And to some degree, what you're seeing is a diminishment in the importance of trade with the United States.
Well, and it's not just China. I mean, all of the BRICS, they're echoing concerns about a dollar-centric world. And, you know, they're looking at alternatives. They've been talking to the IMF, and the IMF has been talking back, actually.
Well, of course, we had the World Cup here recently, and Putin was down there and is meeting with Dilma Rousseff and discussing these things right now. The BRICS are echoing concerns, yes, of a dollar-centric world, yes. Do they like it? No. And they are exploring the alternatives, a replacement of the IMF, a replacement of the World Bank. Real plans, frankly, have yet to emerge. They're in the discussion phase. They're not in an implementation phase. But when they get to that, when they get to that phase, I think you're looking at being so far downriver, so far downstream, that it's shocking to us in the United States. What we will see as an initial trickle from dollars will, I think, very quickly become a flood, as the world over recognizes that the old monetary system is a has-been system. And the BRICS are certainly interested in breaking out of dollar hegemony. That is our control of the entire monetary system. We've had that privilege. Talking to Ben Steele, it was very clear. We've had that privilege since 1944, and it's not something that we get to hold on to by default. We may hold on to it, but it's only going to be by very sagacious policies put in place by those in Washington.
I think it's interesting, too, Dave. These countries that are dissatisfied with the dollar, they're the same countries that are showing major gold purchases, physical gold purchases, moving away from the dollar. So isn't it interesting that you can pretty much define who's not happy right now and who probably is not going to continue to use the dollar exclusively as a reserve currency?
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, last year, what was it, 350 to 400 tons of gold purchased by central banks. And this is the fifth consecutive year of net purchases by central banks. It's a very subtle, but let me tell you, it is a powerful contrast with the last 30 years of central bank liquidations of gold. Now you see a radically different kind of behavior. And it is, as you mentioned, it's countries that have a beef with the U.S. dollar. They're not content with the dollar-centric system, and those are the ones that are accumulating the most gold.
You've got to look sometimes behind the curtain to see what's going on elsewhere, because we were talking about certainty. Okay, the lack of volatility in the stock market, it just continues to quietly rise. You know, I was looking at interest rates. Of course, we've talked and talked and talked about the artificiality of interest rates and how they don't really relate to what true risk is. You cannot measure risk in this environment. And I just wonder, Dave, the stock market continues to rise. We've talked to Andrew Smithers, we've talked to Napier, we've talked to these guys who watch these markets, and they've made a lot of money in the stock market, and they're saying, get the heck out of Dodge, get out of stocks, get into cash, because it's going to fall.
Well, again, we don't have information in the marketplace because real information via interest rates and other measures of risk is being muted by the central bank footprint in the marketplace today. But we're at or near an inflection point in equities. Although we're lacking information, I think there still is evidence. I think there's evidence that we are at an inflection point. For instance, short selling. Short selling is at the lowest level since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. What this means is that bears, those who are thinking that the stock market is going to go down instead of up,
they're non-existent.
They're nearly extinct. And frankly, the only species living on Wall Street today are the bulls. They are the ones who are saying, you know, listen, sky's the limits. There's no place but up. And the belief is the market only goes one direction. And of course, that is supported by central bank pumping of money and standing ready to intervene in the markets to prop up prices and perpetuate these bubble dynamics. Linger on this for just a moment. There are normally a multitude of opinions about a given outcome in the marketplace.
Sure, that's what the market is a multitude of opinions.
Yep, and that's expressed by trading positions. That is, people put their money down and say, I think this is going to grow, or I think this is going to drop in value. So you have these opinions expressed by trading positions which profit from one outcome or another.
But you have virtually no one who's saying it's going to go down. That's what the short position is, isn't it?
Exactly. You profit when the stock price goes down. The lowest number of people who are short the market, now since the collapse of Lehman Brothers. Of course, that was a big surprise. Everyone thought that everything was going great in the real estate market. No one expected it. Everyone called it a black swan. The market believes that these trees grow to the moon.
Well, and you've talked over the last year or so, especially the last half year, about how margin debt, in other words, not only people going in and buying with what they have, but borrowing to buy more. Margin debt has been hitting records, hasn't it, for the last 6 months, 8 months?
Well, through the month of February, we had six successive all-time record numbers. They blew past the records that were set in the year 2000 with the tech boom. They blew past the numbers that we saw, the record numbers in 2007, which were even greater than what we had in the year 2000.
Well, and those were both preceding very substantial crashes.
Right. Well, now we've had 3 months of a minor contraction in the margin debt numbers, which in the past has been prelude to not only a massive decline in the margin debt numbers, but obviously, and this is of greater significance, really a pulling of the plug on the market advance. So the bull market trend that we've had in place for 5 years, when you begin to see margin numbers get to high levels, why is that important to us? Well, because high levels usually come before low levels. I mean, that's just the reality. When you get to new record numbers, there is mean reversion. And that's what we saw happen in 1973 to 74. That's what we saw in 1987. That's what we saw in the year 2000. That's what we saw in the year 2007. When the margin debt numbers begin to contract, it coincides with stocks moving considerably lower.
Well, how much lower would they? I mean, typically, what do they lose when you have that happen?
In those four historical reference points, you're talking about 20 to 50% declines in equities. And again, that doesn't mean that that has to happen now or next week or happen at all in terms of a 20 to 50% decline. But I'm telling you, when we get to new margin levels, all-time highs, and those numbers begin to roll over and move down again, you're basically pulling the plug in terms of speculative investment in the marketplace, and you begin to see a cascade effect. You have, maybe there's exceptions to this, but this is the way it rolled in the bear market of 73, 74, the bear market of 87, bear market of 2000, 2001, bear market of 2007 to 2008.
Well, and Dave, I can remember three of those four bear markets just working here. I mean, 87, the year 2000, the year 2007. Each time, I remember talking to clients who continued to stay in the stock market. Now, granted, a lot of our clients had moved out by then. But I talked to the people who were still there, and they said, you know, when I start to see it come down, I'll get out. I'll start moving out. And it's really more like a game of musical chairs when the music stops, isn't it?
Listen, I looked at the long-term chart of margin debt yesterday on a Bloomberg terminal, and you look at it, and it rises and rises and rises and rises over a long period of time. And then do you know what it's like? It's like stepping into a crevasse. You step into a gap where there's nothing but air underneath you, and you're going down. There is nothing to support you. There is nothing substantive underfoot. You are free falling. This is why one of the reasons why we're in the mountains, and when we are mountaineering in areas where there are crevasses and whatnot, we're always on a rope. Why are we on a rope? Because things happen so quickly, there's nothing that you can do. Unless you have a safety rope, there's nowhere you're going but down and to your harm or demise.
And those crashes that occurred before, they were in markets that didn't have volumes nearly as low as we have these days. I mean, these days we've got rising markets, but actually volumes are incredibly low.
That is a critical point, because what we're talking about is the structure of the market today. Lower and lower volumes, and this isn't just the normal summer doldrums. Classically, you see lower volumes in equity trading during the summer months. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a trend in volumes which has been in place now for about 5 years. Very significant in and of itself. Not just a short-term, but a long-term structural trend. And then you've got this. Much of the existing, again, declining volumes, but much of the existing volume is not from investors or analysts. We're talking about high-frequency traders scalping pennies from the exchanges. It literally, computer black box trading models, buying, selling, hoping to capture a penny or two of gain.
Well, and when a person wants to sell their stock, we're talking about that crevasse going. Let's say you say, okay, today's the day it's a crash. I'm going to go ahead and call my broker and sell. Those high-frequency trades are not going to be the trades that come in and buy those stocks.
There were a few shares that I wanted to sell in 2008. There was a particular day in 2008. With Charles Schwab, I stayed on the phone for 3 hours. Wow. And never got through.
The market kept going down while you were doing it.
Their computer trading system was not taking trades. It was overwhelmed by volume, and we could not input trades online. This is me personally.
Now, right.
This is one of the reasons why, as a firm, or other wealth management group, we don't use that company. I found the frailties of their IT, and it scared the snot out of me. And then you think, well, gosh, well, if I can't put the trade in online, I'll just call. That's right. 3 hours, and guess what time it was by the time I got through? Oh, after 2 o'clock Mountain Standard Time, which is after the market has already closed.
Right, so you get next market's price, next day's market price.
Well, but the thing is, with high-frequency traders, you're talking about volumes which are, if you want to define it with one word, fickle. They can go either way. It doesn't matter. Today they're buying. They can just as easily sell. And again, you've got people out there gambling, speculating based on Fed promises, not economic fundamentals. You're listening for the voice of the Fed. You're not reading the economic tea leaves. It's literally, what is Janet saying today? Because that's the only thing that I care about. That's what's going to move the markets.
Well, and think about it, Dave. I mean, what compounds that is this margin debt that you're talking about. Because once it goes down a certain amount, you get what they call a margin call, and it just compounds on itself. It forces the sale.
You're right, because you layer in what is a speculative investment, margin borrowing from individual investors, and that still is north of $430 billion. Okay, so the peak was just above 450. We're still sitting around 430. It has started to decline, and you say, well, that's healthy. It's declining. No, actually, when it begins to decline, these are the siren songs. These are the things that are telling you, you don't understand what happens next. This is the only thing that was propping up the market except for the high-frequency traders. If you're not moving to the exits right now, you're not going to squeeze through the exits when everyone else wants to. This is the challenge. You have, in addition to this $430 billion, you've got, say, year-to-date, an extra $100 billion of actual investor money. These are retail investors. They're chasing 2013 increases in price, and they're buying equity mutual funds. This, to me, is the makings of a nightmare scenario. Because remember that it's the individual investor that tends to pile in at the end of a rally. And you say, well, $100 billion, that's not much compared to all the other numbers. Yeah, but year-to-date mutual fund inflows, do you know the last time we had $100 billion come in this kind of a time frame? The first quarter of the year 2000. I mean, literally, you've got the lemmings coming right up to the edge and saying, isn't this going to be fun?
Well, and David, I have to bring up, you do have sort of a morbid sense of humor. A few years ago, you and some friends went in on making some wine, and the label still cracks me up because it is a nice, big, fat turkey. And you know, there was more that went into that label than just picking out a picture.
Well, what is the happiest day in the turkey's life? His last day is his happiest day. He's being stuffed and fed right up until the end, but all he sees is the present. All he sees is the past. Listen, all I'm suggesting is that prices are driven by liquidity. And ample liquidity has done its job. We've gotten to these levels because of the liquidity created by the Fed. The Fed's liquidity, yes, it can continue to flow. Because if they so choose, they can run the printing presses ad infinitum. But the investor dollars are not constant. The high-frequency trader dollars are anything but reliable. And the margin money, it has a hurdle. You know what that hurdle is? Those dollars are actually loans which bear interest and will have to be paid back, which means that everyone who has a position in stocks with borrowed funds is watching not only the value of the stock market, but they're watching the clock as well. And they know at some point they're going to have to pull the plug. If prices begin to get twitchy at all in the equity markets, guess what happens? You go ahead and pay back while you can, and hopefully you're above and beyond your original investment. What precipitates the payback? It could be any number of things.
Well, and I wonder, you know, because the Federal Reserve is doing what they said as far as tapering. They're taking a few billion off every month, and they're, what is it, October, November, that they're talking about actually ending quantitative easing. But could that precipitate what you're talking about, Dave?
Yeah, this is an interesting, very coincidental time frame, but you know what it speaks to me? It speaks to me of the absolute ignorance at the Fed. I'm not meaning to belittle or undermine who these men are. Very bright academic men. But we're talking about just looking at the seasonality of the stock market. If any one of them picked up the Stock Trader's Almanac, you know one of the things that they would glean from this?
Yeah, October is not a good month for the stock market.
October is classically the worst month for the stock market of any period in time where you have market crashes. October is it. So, you know, why they are pulling liquidity out leading up to and plan on being finished at this time. You know, they'll be down to roughly $15 billion a month in money printing and asset purchases by October. The Federal Reserve, yes, they still intend to take their maturing securities and reinvest those in treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. That's, you know, call it $16 billion a month, $15, $16 billion a month. Does that make sense?
Right.
You've got individual debt, it's paid off, and then they essentially take the proceeds and recycle it back into new debt.
It's almost like quantitative easing, but it's at a much smaller scale than what they've been doing.
Right. But it'll still enable a drip feed to the mortgage and treasury market, and in theory, that will help contain rates. On the other hand, we know Bernanke's introduction of QE was intentionally, in his words, to loosen monetary policy. So it follows logically that if taking QE off the table is the reverse action, it is in fact going to have the same consequence in the stock market and in the economy. It's the equivalent of tightening monetary policy. And come on, can that have a negative effect on investor sentiment? Sure. Does it sort of constrain the willingness to speculate in equities? Maybe. So if you give it that backdrop, we've just described it's just not unreasonable to suggest a September to October decline in equities.
Well, and you know, Dave, it's interesting looking back at the crashes that you named, you know, and I'm going to think of 87 and 2000 and 2007. There was always some, quote, black swan precipitating event. I mean, even though you can talk about it, see it ahead of time, say, gosh, all the factors are in, there seems to always be what they call a black swan. And they say, gosh, we just didn't see it coming. Sorry, boys and girls. But in reality, they're only controlling interest rates. They can only control the flow of money. They can't control, like, okay, you and Chuck last week talked about ISIS. ISIS sounds like they have a little bit of nuclear material at this point.
Is that
a black swan possibility? I mean, what are things that could trigger?
Well, but see, this is what I don't like about the concept of the black swan. As if it's some surprise. Right now, utilities, the Russell 2000, consumer discretionary stocks, home builders, these are all categories that are diverging from the Dow, industrials, and the S&P 500.
So they're signaling also.
They absolutely are signaling something is not quite right. Because, again, if the economy's strong, wouldn't you expect consumer discretionary to be strong? Wouldn't you expect, if you were looking at the retail stocks, for them to be doing very well and for the expectation to be doing even better? If, in fact, we're coming into a period of economic recharge and growth, and yet, again, retail, consumer discretionary, Russell 2000, utilities, home builders, they're all giving you an indicator that something's not quite right. And even though the S&P 500 and the Dow have been gamed to higher levels, there is this unhealthy divergence. For anybody with their head screwed on straight on Wall Street, I think, you know, this is a time to be eliminating positions, getting into cash, increasing a gold position at low numbers. I mean, these are things where you should be retrenching, not sort of riding the wave, because honestly, this wave, guess what happens? Guess where it lands? It crashes on the beach. It crashes. And again, is this a permutation that we think we could see in the next 2 days? No. 2 weeks? Maybe not.
Well, you can't predict it, Dave.
What Smithers said in November was absolutely telling. He said, listen, valuation metrics don't give you any insight in terms of timing. We can look and say, according to Tobin's Q or the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiple, that we're somewhere between 75 and now 95% overvalued in your major indexes. But that doesn't mean that they don't go from being overvalued to super overvalued.
Right. When does the bridge collapse? You know, I think about that bridge in Minnesota. It was a tragedy. But the bird poop had built up and built up and built up, and the chemicals had gotten underneath it, and finally, that was your catastrophe, okay? Somebody, unfortunately, was under the bridge and on the bridge when it occurred, but it was going to happen.
Yeah, you mentioned Smithers when we started off the conversation today, and I think, yeah, that's right. For the trader, there's still money to be made in the stock market. For the investor, you know what? Your better days are gone. You should be on the sidelines. Follow Smithers' advice. Increase your percentage to cash, if not move to cash entirely, if you're an overcommitted equity speculator. Again, what do you have in your favor? You've got Fed intervention in the marketplace in your favor. That's the primary wind at your back. Will it continue to work? Sure, up until the point where it doesn't. And what you have is a growing number of factors. Again, whether it's margin debt, whether it's the fickleness of high-frequency traders, there's all kinds of things that you could say, you know, I should probably be a little bit more cautious here. That you mentioned Iraq. Yeah, they just communicated. Their UN secretary just communicated with the U.S. that they had the ISIL or ISIS, whatever you want to call it, took 80 pounds, equivalent to 40 kilos, of radioactive material from a university research facility. I mean, come on. The primary concern is that you've got a dirty bomb that can be constructed. No, not a full nuclear weapon.
Sure, a dirty bomb is just it's nuclear materials that are blown up with conventional explosives.
Right, so it's a device that could be, nonetheless, disruptive, given the lingering effects of contamination from the radiation. So how do we think about these things? We categorize these types of issues as low probability problems with very high risk outcomes, which obviously can be exaggerated or exacerbated by general market panic. That's exactly what we had in 9/11. I remember watching the Twin Towers. I was at work at Morgan Stanley, usually the first one to open the office, and with television on, watched the planes fly into the towers. Then I also watched 500, 600, 700 point declines in the stock market the next several days. There was general market panic as a result of this low probability, high risk outcome. Listen, right now, are we directly threatened by what ISIS or ISIL took from the university? No. But you never know what circumstances might align themselves for a surprise. And of course, today, this is the awkward part. Today, the markets are priced for a perfect and perfectly functioning world.
Certainty. Yeah, it's what we talked about before. They have certainty towards certain outcomes.
And this is what's interesting to me. ISIS doesn't cooperate with the central bank community. So you have to be aware of markets freaking out when they discover that central bankers don't actually control the universe, they merely control interest rates. And of course, they do their best to control investors' short-term perceptions of reality.
Well, and you know, speaking of that, it's still a great time to continue to accumulate gold. You know, I think of periods of time like now, Dave. I mean, gold continued to go up over the last couple of weeks, and now the profit takers have taken a little bit of a profit. I mean, isn't this expiration week? This is usually a good time to pick a little up.
Yep, options expiration any month. You can usually look at volatility the week of expirations in the options and futures contracts, and what you're going to find is that people start targeting a particular number. In this case, we're close enough to 1,300. Yeah, 1,300 or sub 1,300, that jives with a trader's self-interest. So we've got temporary gyrations, not a big deal. What you usually see seasonally is gold reaches its low point sometime between May and the end of July. I think probably we've already had the lows in early May. Now, the implication is, and if you wanted to look at, say, 19 out of the last 21, 22 years, you know, as some sort of a sample size, prices are up 15, 20, 25% from those lows by the time you get into September, October, November. And it's no coincidence that sometimes the high point in the gold market is actually in a period of time where there's a lot of pressure in equities. So, I mean, there's some seasonality here. You tie it to Ramadan, you tie it to the Indian wedding season.
Or just technicals. I mean, David Gerwitz just looks at the technical charts. We had him on, what, 2.5, 3 months ago, and he said, you know, I think just from the charts, the end of June is probably the bottom on gold. And that's not too far from what has seemed to be the truth.
Yeah, I would look at these temporary gyrations and say, you know, it's not a big deal. If you're adding to ounces, this is the time frame to do it. I wouldn't be waiting until September, October.
Well, and what would you rather have? Stocks, bonds, cash, or gold? Those are your choices, really, if you're not counting real estate.
Yeah, you know, if I'm heavily exposed to stocks, then I'm moving to cash first. And then the question is, how comfortable am I with the Federal Reserve managing my cash assets? And I have the feeling that over the next several years, they will do anything to keep the banking system alive, even if it costs them stability or value of the dollar. So you really catch 22 at this point as an investor. I think you look at stocks, bonds, and they're overpriced. Real estate in most places is overpriced. Moving to cash, sure, that makes sense. But then you have to balance the risk that you have with those resources being managed by Yellen and company. And what's my sense? My sense is that at the end of the day, you'll be Yellen. You would rather have some balance. You'd rather have some ounces to offset the unintended consequences of well-intentioned but poorly executed monetary policy. At the end of the day, that's where we're at. It's the middle of summer. Prices are getting better. And would I do something? I would. I'd do something right now.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.
Lord.